sign the petition. Are they quite willing to help you?
You know, we feel that, yes, there are 90,000 to 100,000 people in New York City that has a population of 8 million that will absolutely sign. And
Are you just going from door to door? Are you just standing on street corners? What are you doing? How are you getting the signatures?
Yeah, we go to neighborhoods. We go to city parks, busy subway stops, intersections, and that's basically it.
Are you getting a lot of help from people there, right, left? Doesn't matter where they stand on the political spectrum. I think we all want to know what really happened that day, because there were so many things that happened. For instance, I mean, the fact that the plane that hit the North Tower, supposedly the passport of one of those terrorists who was in that plane, somehow got out of his pocket, got out of the flaming wreckage of the plane, got out of the flaming wreckage of the North Tower, and was able to just drift down on the waves of wind and land on the sidewalk about a block and a half away from the North Tower, and was picked up and turned in. And sure enough, it was the passport of one of those wicked terrorists who was supposedly on the plane. Of course, at least six or eight of those terrorists are still alive, living over in the Middle East, which doesn't make any sense, and the government's never tried to explain that. But I never have been able to understand how that passport could have gotten out of the, well, unless maybe he rolled down the window of the plane before it crashed, so it would actually get out of the plane. But a lot tells me that couldn't have happened. The fact that basically that morning they were holding, I don't know how many war games, but I know one of them specifically involved, you know, a plane being hijacked and flown into a building. So how could it be that Condoleezza Rice could said, who would ever imagine to do something like that, fly a plane, use it as a weapon, and yet they were holding war games that morning that were simulating that. In fact, those of you out there in the listening audience have never read my article on what happened at that time, or why we simply quote from Vanity Fair's article pointing out that on that morning there were 29 hijackings, and of course most of them were being simulated as part of the war games, but they couldn't tell which were the real war games and which were the real hijackings, which were the war games. 29 hijackings. No wonder the people who were in charge of protecting our skies were confused. You wonder why they would have done that, and the average American has never heard what was in the Vanity Fair article and the gentleman who wrote that great article. But I think the other thing that really has always made me very concerned was the fact that if you look at the picture of the crash site in Shanksville in Pennsylvania, there's no plane wreckage. A major plane crashed there, all the people, all the bodies, everything, at that site, and but there's no wreckage there, just a big hole in the ground. And although the wreckage of the plane was strewn over a period of about 8 miles, nothing at the crash site, which just doesn't make sense, does it?
Dr. Stan, there's a former NSA analyst by the name of Wayne Mattson who recently told us that there is now a declassified document admitting that Flight 93 was shot down in Pennsylvania. There is now written, documented testimony to this effect.
How would that be? The American people would never know it, Leslie. I mean, wouldn't the American people know it if there was documentation of this sort?
Unfortunately, no. There's so much that we do not know because, of course, our corporate media, which everybody, the majority of people get their news from, is lying to us. We got lied to last week, Dr. Stan, when the report came out on Building 7, which is the third building that fell that day. Again, how many people in the public are aware that a third building collapsed at free fall speed into its own footprint? It was a 47-story, steel-framed, state-of-the-art building that collapsed without being struck by an airplane 7 hours after the attacks. And finally, the report came out a week ago, and here was the explanation by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is an agency that operates under the Commerce Department. They said that these small fires, office fires, like from office materials, caught this one steel girder in the building to buckle, and then that caused like a domino effect and caused the whole building just to fail.
Well, wait a minute. Now, there are a lot of steel girders. If one of them failed, that wouldn't cause all the others to fail. For our listeners out there, ladies and gentlemen, go to our website, radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And if you scroll down to the section on other videos, and then scroll down there to building number 7, and you can actually see the building coming down. But what's so interesting about it, in the controlled demolition, the center of the building collapses first, and they do that. They knock out the center pillar so that the building will collapse inward rather than collapse outward. And no sooner does the center of the building collapse and the center of the roof collapses inward, then, of course, the base of the building collapses simultaneously, and it comes down in its own shadow. And we actually have a 4-tape set called Why Do the Buildings Come Down, which, of course, includes a 2-hour testimony, a 2-hour interview. The fellow was there the following day in charge of cleaning up the mess, and he says 99% chance that it was a controlled demolition. And, of course, if you look at the DVD we posted, the YouTube, why the interview demolition experts have said, of course it was a controlled demolition. Well, how could Osama bin Laden have managed a controlled demolition of that building? And if Osama bin Laden didn't, you know, manage the controlled demolition, then who did? And if they're lying to us about Building 7, is it possible they're lying about what else happened that day? I think that's the biggest question, don't you, Les? I mean, if they lie about one thing, you can never believe anything they say about anything else that happened.
Yeah, very true. And there's so many lies. And that's why this ballot initiative is such a paramount importance. And if people would like to learn more about this, the website is nyc911initiative.org.
I'll give that one more time, very slowly.
Sure. It's nyc911initiative.org. And what we ask, Dr. Stan, because I know you have a huge audience around the country, if your audience knows anybody here in New York City, please direct them to our website.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, I guess it's Les Jamison. He's talking about their efforts, of course, to get this initiative, you know, signed, get enough signatures, and they can turn this in. And, of course, people all across the country should be concerned, because if they could have an independent investigation in New York, maybe we could get some of the questions we have answered. And, of course, we could find out why, for instance, if you go to the FBI website, that's the FBI website, for the 10 most wanted men in the nation, you can get that at Google. And, of course, one of the 10 most wanted men in the world is Osama bin Laden. But if you read the reasons he's wanted, well, there's no mention of what happened on September 11th. Why wouldn't the FBI know that he was involved in that, you know, attack on the World Trade Center, if that was really the case? And you would think that was one of the major reasons they'd want to get him. You know, certainly they talk about, of course, what happened as far as the bombings of the American embassies in Kenya and then Tanzania, but no mention of September 11th. That seems to be a terrible oversight on the part of the FBI, don't you think, Les?
It's not actually an oversight, because an investigative reporter by the name of Ed Haas called the FBI to inquire on this very point that you raised, Dr. Stan, and he was told by the FBI field agent that the reason they do not list 9/11 as a cause for bin Laden being wanted is because they said they have no definitive proof. And we have to remember that shortly after 9/11, the Bush administration said to the Taliban in Afghanistan, turn over bin Laden. We want him for the events of 9/11, the attacks of 9/11. And they said, absolutely. We'll turn him over. Just show us the evidence that he's guilty. And guess what? We never provided the evidence that he was guilty for 9/11, and therefore the Taliban realized that this is not what occurred.
Of course, the other interesting thing is the Taliban then offered to send Osama bin Laden out of the country, and of course that would not suit our leaders, and then, of course, they said, well, we'll send him to another country to be tried by an independent trial. We will arrest him and send him to another country. But that would not satisfy our leaders. Our leaders insisted he be turned over without, of course, any evidence that he was involved in what had happened that day. And people did not understand the culture of Arabic nations, of Muslim nations. And that is, if somebody is living in your home, why, first, you are there to protect them. You do not endanger their lives, even though you don't like them. And I will tell you, of course, that the Taliban did not like Osama bin Laden. In fact, at an earlier date, Muhammad Omar, had actually offered to turn Osama bin Laden over long before 9/11 to the Americans. The Americans turned down his offer, and that's all covered and documented in our pamphlet, Foreknowledge 9/11. And I do hope, if you're out there in the audience, you'll get those pamphlets and read them through and understand that we were intent upon going to war. It didn't matter whether Osama bin Laden was, and we certainly weren't trying to get Osama bin Laden. We quote from an article, and we have the article, anybody wants to see it, in the Washington Times, before the American troops landed in Afghanistan, I think there was the 5th or 6th of October, saying that, you know, a high government official said, we're not trying to get Osama bin Laden. Our policy is not to get Osama bin Laden first. If we were to get Osama bin Laden first, how would we justify the coming war? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is Les Jamison. We're talking about what really happened on September 11th. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, we'd love to talk to you. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But Les is certainly leading the effort, the drive to collect 30,000 legitimate signatures. They'd like to get 100,000 legitimate signatures, because you can be sure there'll be a lot of bribes, a lot of money will exchange hands, a lot of threats to prevent this initiative from getting on the ballot. And if it does get on the ballot and get passed, to prevent an independent investigation. The Bush administration did everything they could to prevent an independent investigation, and we just have to ask ourselves why. Well, are you getting any support at all from the local newspapers, the local television, local radio?
Dr. Stan?
Yes, go ahead.
The reality is that we, the citizens, we, the people, outnumber the forces that would try to oppose a true investigation. The forces that want to keep the reality secret. We outnumber them 1,000,000,000 to 1, and this is what we have to show, and this is what we can show. We have a phenomenal, unprecedented opportunity through this ballot initiative to literally show the oligarchy, the political structure, who's boss. We are boss, and through the power of the petition, we can create a mandate for truth and accountability for 9/11. Again, I want to urge your audience, anybody they know in the New York City area, please send them to the website nyc911initiative.org.
Can they get to that initiative simply by putting in your, Googling in your name, Les Jamison?
No. They should go directly to the website that I'm giving. And here's what we're asking, Dr. Stan. Also, if they know people in and around the city, if you say Long Island, New Jersey, or Connecticut, still send them to the website. They can come into the New York City and petition with us, because we need to put together an army of volunteers to, you know, each get 10, 15, 20, 50 signatures, and this is how we'll get to 100,000. And this is what we can do here in New York City. Also, this, like any campaign, which this is absolutely a political campaign of sorts, we need financial support, and thousands of people, if they can just help us out with $20, $25, that would help us to pay petitioners and staff and materials and for banners and so forth. This is what will make this a reality, and we have a phenomenal base now, and we've gotten some press here in New York. This was in New York Magazine recently. We have the support of people like Jesse Ventura, Ralph Nader, Dan Ellsberg, Dallas football players, Mark Stepnowski, Grammy Award winning hip hop artist Arrested Development, actress Christine Ebersole, and more. This is unbelievably the most substantial, legitimate, well-structured effort ever to date that has the potential to create a true, authentic 9/11 investigation, which the government has failed to do and will not do on its own. That's why it's going to require an effort from the grassroots, which is what we're all about here in New York City. Again, please go to the website nyc911initiative.org. Also, if you do not have the internet, we have a hotline, which is 646-537-1755. Come get involved.
First of all, as you always repeat your telephone number at least three times, so go ahead and repeat it one more time. What was the telephone number again?
Yeah, 646-537-1755.
All right, fine. And I think it's so. Are you getting any opposition there for trying to do this? In other words, are some of the media experts trying to put pressure on you, or is pressure coming from other areas? Because the last thing they want is for the truth to come out about what really happened that day.
Well, they're ignoring us at this point up to now.
Well, that's good.
We had a great press conference here with Senator Mike Gravel and others, and. The local news stations were notified, and of course they did not show up. So that's mainly it. But wait till we get to 50,000 signatures and more organizations and in alliance with us. You know, they're going to have to pay attention sooner or later, and it's within our power to create this kind of attention for.
Yeah, is Mike Gravel still? Mike Gravel, Senator Gravel, still over here in the Monterey Bay area? He was living here in the past. Is he still over here?
No, he's now near D.C. in Fairfax, Virginia.
All right, fine. Well, I'm sorry. We've actually had him here at my studio. We've interviewed him. I mean, we would disagree on many things, but I think he's an honest man. And I think he's a courageous man. And so you're lucky to have him there with you. We'll be back in just a moment with Les Jamison. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Les Jamison, and Les, of course, is talking about their effort to collect signatures so they can get a initiative passed. And once that initiative is passed, they can have an independent investigation there in New York City with subpoena power. And, of course, they have a very distinguished, actually, a panel already. People have already agreed to be on the panel to look into the background, to hear both sides, and try to determine what really happened that day. Now, certainly, the tragedy is that there was an investigation. It was the 9/11 Commission. 1,100 people were questioned in secret. And the testimony, 1,200 people were questioned in secret, and the testimony of 1,100 of them was sealed for 50 years. Now, why in heaven's name would they seal the testimony of 1,100 people who knew what happened that morning for 50 years? I mean, are they trying, as I've said so many times, to conceal the evidence from Osama bin Laden? Are they trying to conceal the evidence from Mullah Omar, the blind Sikh who headed the Taliban? Are they trying to conceal this from the Muslims here in the United States? Or are they trying to conceal the truth from the American people? So, basically, you must be talking to a lot of people back there, Les. I mean, what is the response of the people? Do they think that this is a worthwhile effort? Do they think, well, hum-ho, or that maybe we ought to be concerned about more pertinent or more current? What sort of response do you get when you talk to people? Because I'm sure you do talk to a lot of them.
Yes, thousands of New Yorkers, and it's a very mixed response. There is still, unfortunately, far too much indifference and people of just avoiding anything political. There's far too much, entertainment culture where people are just addicted to and controlled by the media and the entertainment culture. But that said, there are enough people who are very alarmed at the political reality that we've been in since the year 2000 with, you know, the two invasions that we're involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, the issues of torture, of surveillance, and all the lies that we've been told, the way the government reacted to Hurricane Katrina. And there are enough people that realize, you know, that there's something fishy about what we've been told about 9/11. It just doesn't add up. How could these, you know, young Arabs with box cutters who are at best amateur pilots pull this off? No, can't.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Les Jemison right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Les Jemison. And Les is a name that raising some very serious questions. And that is, how could 19, inexperienced, young Arab men, young Muslims, carry out such a complicated hijacking? How could they fly those planes? Because many of them were not accomplished planes, and yet, of course, the things that actually happened needed very, very experienced pilots. And certainly, talking to pilots, experienced pilots, they will tell you that it'd almost be impossible to do what they did at the Pentagon, to do what they did as far as crashing into the, into the South Tower. Certainly, the North Tower was a straight on, but the South Tower was a declining, certainly a spiral that they had to get to hit the building. It would take somebody with a great deal of experience to actually maneuver that plane, and none of these men had ever actually flown a major airliner. So there are a lot of unanswered questions, but I think, of course, one that vexes me the most is, how was it possible that two of the passports survived? The one of the passport of one of the hijackers was supposedly in the plane that hit the North Tower, and that somehow got out of the hijacker's pocket. They were in the plane and the flaming wreckage of the plane, and then out of the flaming wreckage of the plane, and then out of the flaming World Trade Center, and just was able to float down to land on the street, about a block and a half away from the North Tower, without a mark on it. Now, of course, it was another one of the passports that survived at Shanksville, and it survives the crash. In fact, it's amazing because there was no wreckage there. The only thing that survived the crash was, well, at least in the crash site that I saw, was this passport, and it was a little bit singed and burned, but it was another one of the hijackers. Nobody else's passport survived. I mean, certainly there was wreckage. It was over an 8-mile area, but at the crash site, there was just nothing there but a big hole in the ground. And the question is, you look at that, you ask yourself, what happened to the wings of the plane? What happened to the tail of the plane? What happened to all the luggage and all the things that were in the plane? And, and of course, if you want to look at it intelligently, you have to question, Mark, did the plane really crash there, or did it explode in the air? And, of course, you have to make these decisions yourself. You have to start thinking. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk to Les. And, of course, once again, Les, I want you to give out your website and your telephone number.
Absolutely. The website is nyc911initiative.org. And this is where you'll see all the details. That's the official website. You'll see what you can do regardless of where you live and throughout the country, because this is a national issue. We're all affected every day by what happened on 9/11. Our phone number is a hotline, which is 646-537-1755. That's 646-537-1755. There are all kinds of ways that people can help, and this is the cause, folks, where we can create a sea change event, which is to call to task our government that has been operating beyond the rule of law. It's been in violation of the Constitution, and they've used 9/11, of course, to decimate our civil liberties, and of course launch two invasions and deplete our treasury and put us into trillions and trillions of dollars of debt that will never, ever, be paid off, and just have totally jeopardized the stability of this country. We cannot stand for this. We have to realize that we the people outnumber the perpetrators of this whole agenda by a billion to one. But we must realize that knowledge requires action, and this is a vehicle by which everybody can get behind and support and bring about the change that is so necessary if we're to restore this country to the status that it needs to be. And again, it's NYC911initiative.org. We ask for your referrals to anybody you know here in the New York City area. We also ask for your financial support. With the right funding, we can get ads on TV, take out a page in the New York Times. We can do a direct mailing to hundreds of thousands of New York City voters. What could be more invaluable? And folks, in comparison, these political campaigns going on right now, they raise hundreds of millions of dollars, and they will never achieve what the NYC 9/11 ballot initiative has the potential of achieving.
Well, do you have some sort of a committee that you're working with, Les? You're pretty well doing this thing on your own.
No, we have a committee here in New York City of just ad hoc folks who are activists, who are working petitioning and planning and strategizing and scheduling. Dr. William Pepper has been integral to guiding us and leading the effort. And there's a local Episcopalian pastor by the name of Frank Morales. He's an expert on martial law and the provisions of the police state that have emerged especially the past decade, and myself, who I'm a longtime organizer and activist here in New York City. I've been on the streets of New York since January of 2004. It's going to be 5 years here, almost on a weekly basis, just educating and trying to call for the citizens of New York to take heed here. And actually, we have people from all over the world who come. And we've been giving out information that the corporate media has deprived the public of. So that's what we've been doing here in New York. And so we have a great team, and we invite more to come and be part of this historic and heroic effort.
Well, of course, Mr. William Pepper is quite well known to me. For our listeners out there who do not know Mr. William Pepper, Mr. Pepper, of course, is the gentleman who represented the family of Martin Luther King at a very, very famous trial. Famous because, of course, nobody ever heard of it. It was a trial that was brought by the King family against a man named Lloyd Zowers, who was part and parcel of the conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. The trial went on for 3 or 4 months. There were some 50 different witnesses there. The jury found that the government was responsible, 70% responsible, for the murder of Martin Luther King. It was a CIA operation. They hired the mafia. They hired Lloyd Zowers. And the whole story is told in a book, An Affair of State, which we carry. And, of course, we have a 4-tape set with interviews with Lloyd Zowers, William Pepper, going into the background of the murder of Martin Luther King. Pepper is one of these people who really feels very strongly about what's going on. He spent probably 20 years studying and researching the background of the murder of Martin Luther King, who was murdered by the government because, of course, he was becoming really too much of a problem. He wanted to lead a march on Washington, D.C., and they wanted to get rid of him. And they were afraid, of course, he would rally people, get a million people there in Washington, D.C., put pressure on them, get us out of the Vietnam War. They didn't want to get out of the war. They wanted to go on and kill as many more people as we possibly could. And so they had to get rid of Martin Luther King. And so he was killed back in what I guess was 1968, somewhere in there. But anyway, of course, it's a fascinating 4-tape set, if you've never heard of that, or never read the book, by William Pepper. So I think you're very, very fortunate to have William Pepper. He's one of those rare people maybe a little eccentric, sort of like myself, who believes there's a problem, then he has a moral obligation to be involved. He's an international lawyer. He's not simply, an activist. He's an international lawyer. He's internationally known. But he invested 4 months of his life, well, really 20 years of his life or more, trying to get the truth out about Martin Luther King. But because, of course, of the control of the mass media, no one, or probably not one American in 100,000, has ever heard of the trial that was brought by the Martin Luther King family against Lloyd Jowers. So anyway, that's the story of William Pepper, and I think you're very, very fortunate to have him, Les, as far as part of your team. And certainly, I mean, many of the people you've mentioned certainly are radical leftists. I don't care whether they're leftists, rightists, they get pointed heads. The important thing is they want to get to the truth, and everybody out in the listening audience ought to want to get to the truth about what really happened, because almost 3,000 Americans died that morning. And the question is, who is responsible? If Osama bin Laden is responsible, then the FBI ought to know about it. But you go to the FBI website. You can find it on the Internet. You can Google in 10 most wanted FBI, and you'll get to the website, and you'll find that the FBI doesn't even mention the attack on September 11th, along with why they're looking for Osama bin Laden. So you have to ask yourself, have we been told the truth? Is it just possible that we have not been told the truth, and that there is someone, I'm not suggesting it's President Bush, but that someone in our intelligence agencies or in some branch of government is concealing the truth from the American people? I would simply point out that if you look at the 9/11 Commission, there were 10 people on it. 5 of them came from the Council on Foreign Relations, and so did Mr. Philip Zelikow. He was the counsel who ran the whole committee meeting. Actually, they had one senator on the commission who wanted to get to the bottom of things, so they got rid of him. They didn't want anybody on the commission who wanted to get the truth. They wanted people who would go along with Philip Zelikow, a close personal friend of Condoleezza Rice, member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And Philip Zelikow, the counsel for the commission, made sure that nothing that brought out the truth was ever allowed to be seen in public. It was totally stage managed.
Remember that Philip Zelikow was also one of the architects of the Iraq war strategy.
Right.
He had written a paper on catastrophic terrorism, which basically mapped out a response to an event like 9/11. And this was several years beforehand. So if, you know, we study this type of strategizing that went on, as well as the paper called Rebuilding America's Defenses by Project for a New American Century, which is the ultra-right-wing, well, neoconservative think tank that has members such as Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, John Bolton, Jeb Bush, Irving Kristol, the neocons, basically, they mapped out a strategy to create military transformation that would create the conditions for military supremacy and full-spectrum dominance. I'm using their terminology, but they said that the American people would only support this agenda if there were to be a catastrophic, catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. Now, this was published in the year 2000, but this was taken from literature that had been developed over years of prior strategizing. And you would think that something like this, that shows a direct correlation to what occurred on 9/11, you'd think that would be public knowledge and would have been thoroughly investigated and seen as a lead, you know, just like in any criminal trial. You take whatever evidence there is and you treat it like a lead until you get to the source of the crime. Well, that did not occur, folks. And, you know, this is just one more piece of evidence in a mountain of evidence showing that we have not been given anything close to the truth on what occurred on 9/11, and that there was an agenda, that the plans for war, to invading Afghanistan for an oil pipeline, as well as plans for invading Iraq, were all in place prior to 9/11. What does this mean? We should, you know, be asking these very, very compelling questions. Why is it that it took 14 months after the attacks of 9/11 before the government even authorized an investigation? They were not going to have an investigation were it not for the effort of the 9/11 widows. Why is it that on the morning of 9/11, within an hour of the attacks, they had bin Laden's face all over TV and had him all tried and convicted with zero evidence that he was the perpetrator of an orchestrator of 9/11?
I think what's even more interesting is that the FBI, which is obviously so incompetent that they let this thing happen, within 24 hours knew who all of the people were, had their pictures, you know, and they had their pictures, their whole life history, and you can read them in the, I think it, the article appeared in the New York Times about 72 hours after the attack, but within 24 hours they knew everything about all of the people. They had their pictures, their life history, everything about them. They even knew what they'd been doing here in the United States. How could they have been so competent after the attack and yet did nothing to try to stop the attack ahead of time? I think that's a very good question. As far as that pamphlet, Rebuilding America's Defenses, it was on the neoconservative Project for the New American Century website. Up until recently, it's not been taken down, but if you want to get it, it's available through Radio Liberty. It's called Rebuilding America's Defenses. You can get it by itself or as part of our syllabus on Iraq, The Untold Story. That's the syllabus of Iraq, The Untold Story. You really should get the DVD that goes with that, called War, The Untold Story, or Iraq, The Untold Story. You need to have the information. Of course, you need to read it. You need to get others to understand that it's just exactly as Les said. They said the only way we were going to be able to build up our defenses and get the people behind our foreign policy, our aggressive foreign policy, was if there was another Pearl Harbor, or the words that affect another Pearl Harbor. They also talked about how wonderful it is now we're going to be able to come up with new diseases that we can target specific races with. Target specific races? Yes, of course, use this to wipe out these new diseases, to wipe out specific races. You're dealing with people who have a different worldview, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to see that pamphlet that Les was talking about, it's called Rebuilding America's Defenses. It's available through Radio Liberty, or we suggest you get it as part of the syllabus and get that talk on the Iraq, The Untold Story, because you've never got the real reason why we went to war. You've never been told the truth about what really happened on September 11th. And, of course, if we're not getting the truth from the media, where will we get it? Well, of course, we have programs like this. And Les is out there standing on the street corners there in New York literally every weekend and with some of his friends trying to educate the American people. And I would simply ask our listeners, what are you willing to do to try to get the truth out, to find out who is responsible for the murder of almost 3,000 Americans on that day? In fact, very interesting. Remember, if you go back, they kept telling it was 6,000 Americans that died that morning. 6,000 died that morning, and then they came up with 5, and then 4, and then 3. Of course, 6,000 were supposed to die. And had it not been for the fact that a gentleman in charge of security, or Morgan Stanley, had raced up and down the aisles on the two floors of Morgan Stanley, telling people to ignore the orders that were coming off the public address system to get out of the building, whereas the people on the public address were telling them to stay at their seats, there was nothing to worry about, another almost 3,000 would have perished that day. I think somebody knew what was going on. They can't let the American people know. Well, Les, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. Go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sanford, for having me on tonight and for your show and all the educational effort that you've done so diligently and masterfully. And, you know, the issue of 9/11 is not old news. It is current news. We are affected every minute by what happened on 9/11. We must realize that we have a duty and an obligation to the victims, to the victims' families, to the first responders who have been so badly treated. We have a responsibility to ourselves and to future generations to do everything within our power to have the truth of 9/11 exposed. And it can only happen through a true, authentic 9/11 investigation which is what the NYC 9/11 ballot initiative is designed to create, where through the public referendum process, we enable the voters to demand of it, of its government to put into law, New York City charter law, a provision to create an independent commission that will have will conduct a thorough, fact-driven investigation with subpoena power. And this is what needs to occur, which is only going to happen if we, the people, demand it. So we're asking for all your listeners around the country to visit our website, learn all about it. That is nyc911initiative.org, or a hotline number, 646-537-1755. Urge anyone you know in New York City to go there. They can download the petition. They can volunteer through our guest book. And all anybody can help through donations of even $20, $25. I say the cost of an average meal for two will make a very big difference. Please sign our guest book so you can keep abreast of our developments. We have 28,000 signatures now, and we want to get it to, you know, 75, 80, 100,000 signatures, which we can do. Imagine if we get just 1,000 New Yorkers, get 10 signatures a week, and this goes on for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 months, we will absolutely overpower any opposition, and that's what we must envision.
One more time. Let's get your telephone number up one more time.
Yeah. The website is nyc911initiative.org. And the web, the hotline is 646-537-1755.
Bye-bye. We're out of time, Les. God bless. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Doctor.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And of course, I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Les. This is an issue we must never let die. Of course, you'd like to get that report put out by the neocons talking about how we were going to have another Pearl Harbor. Why, I said, Nee, we hope that you'll get that from Radio Liberty or by itself or as part of our talk on Iraq, the Untold Story, and the syllabus goes with that DVD. And then, of course, we have these pamphlets, Foreknowledge 9-1-1, there are three of them, inexpensive. We have another pamphlet called The True Story of 9-1-1 that will bring you pretty well up to date on what we have and what we know. We carry, of course, the DVD, 9-1-1 Mystery. We carry the DVD in plain sight. And, of course, we have actually about five DVDs going on to what happened that morning. We carry a book, excellent book. It's called Terror Timeline, and simply written by Paul Thompson. We're following through, of course, the whole story of what happened going back really many years with the development of this Islamic radical movement, financed by the Central Intelligence Agency to create the best enemy money could buy. But we can't let the American people know that. They've got to believe the typical line, of course, that all the Muslims hate us. They're doing everything they can, of course, to get the American people to hate the Muslims and get the Muslim people to hate the Americans so that we can have a war. In fact, if you've been following the story in the New York Times recently about the Tyler family over in Switzerland that have been sending a nuclear technology, nuclear information over to Mr. Khan in Pakistan. And what happened to all the records of this? Why our government, the CIA, demanded that the Swiss government destroy all the records. Why? Because the last thing they want is for the American people to know that our government is building up the nuclear capacity of Pakistan in preparation for the coming World War III. And you say, that's crazy talk. Well, of course, you need to go to my website, radioliberty.com, pull down the Sybil Edmonds story. It's January 2008, and read it through. And then, of course, go to the Internet and read the story of Mr. Tyler, the Tyler family over in Switzerland, which at the behest of the CIA was funneling technology and information to the Pakistanis about building a bomb so they could transfer it to Iran and to Libya and other countries, probably to North Vietnam as well. And you see, that's crazy. It's just as crazy as the fact that American corporations were building up the war-making capacity of Adolf Hitler, both as far as his tanks and his trucks and his dive bombers, you know, and Exxon, Standard Oil over there, was actually, it was called Esso at the time, was giving Hitler's factories the ability to create the high-octane gasolines for their planes in preparation for the war. In fact, in our syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story, there's even a letter I found among Colonel House's papers written by an American ambassador to Germany in 1936 asking why American corporations were building up the German war-making capacity when nobody wanted a war over there. Well, of course, the people who wanted the war were the American corporate elite here in the United States, which tied to what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. The book, if you'd like a copy of that a letter, it's in the Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus. But if you get anything else and you can request it, we'll send you a copy of the letter from the American ambassador, Ambassador Dodd, the letter he sent to Colonel House in 1936. And you need to understand that we created the best enemy money could buy at that time in Adolf Hitler, just as we're doing the same thing by transferring nuclear technology to Pakistan in preparation for the coming war with a Muslim world. When you understand that, things begin to make sense. You've got to help us get the information out. Remember our number? It's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, our website's RadioLiberty.com. You can listen to our programs there 9 hours a day. Many of our other programs are archived. Of course, you can listen to us on the Internet, on shortwave, on satellite, on radio. It's expensive. We do need your help. If you can help us, if you're in a position to, please do. We're going to start a new program next Monday in Spokane at drive time 4 to 5. If you can help, we'd love to hear from you. Please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. And for the news, behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be those of Mr. William Grigg, a former senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, writing his blogs and certainly working with the Welch Foundation, keeping up their blog site, the author of a book which we carry, Liberty in Eclipse. But, Chris, we're privileged to have him with us a couple of times a week as we begin to explore what is really going on behind the scenes. Because, ladies and gentlemen, if you believe the media, you're not going to understand what's going on. America's facing the greatest economic peril we've ever faced. And, of course, when we get up the other side of this in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, this is going to be a different America. We will either, of course, regain our freedom, or we'll be living in a corporate fascist state, where, of course, freedom as we know it today will simply become a remembrance of things past. Well, William, what are we going to talk about tonight?
Dr. Stan, I appreciate you having me on again, and I do think that we're facing really a pivotal phase in our history as a nation, as a society. I do think that you're entirely correct when you say that over the next several years, we're going to be facing upheavals and turmoil, the likes of which are going to be a crucible. And when that crucible cools down a little bit, and when what has been heated up and mixed around in that crucible is extruded from it, it's going to be a very different society. And your hope and mine is that as these institutions that have been engrafted onto our constitutional republic that are foreign to our republic start to collapse, that people will be prompted to go back and take a look at what we have been given, what our heritage was that we were given by our founders, and reconnect with that element of our patrimony. And of course, the other possibility is that people will be driven even more deeply into the murderous arms of this horrible entity that is the current state that rules us. And I think that it would be interesting just for a minute or two to talk about something we don't discuss often here, and that is electoral politics as such, with the selection of Sarah Palin as the running mate for John McCain here in the presidential tilt in November. I think we're seeing something that is a really interesting play by one half of this establishment dyad that is running for president here. I mean, there really isn't a whole lot of difference between Obama and McCain. We've talked about that. We've emphasized and underlined that point. It's something that we really cannot overemphasize. The fact that Obama's running mate, Joe Biden, a number of years ago expressed the desire to run as a vice presidential candidate with John McCain tells us pretty much everything we need to know about the fungibility of the two wings of the establishment party, whether you're talking about the Democrats or the Republicans. They're basically within a couple of points of the compass of each other politically, ideologically. Sarah Palin is somebody who's a little bit further afield. She's somebody who's a native of Idaho. She was born in Sandpoint, which is a lovely community in the northern part of the state. Geographically, it's part of Idaho. Culturally and economically, it's really more of a part of Washington, I would contend. But she ended up in Alaska as a youngster, came back down to Idaho, northern Idaho, to attend the university in Moscow here, and played basketball, went back up to Alaska, became a sports reporter, then got involved in electoral politics. She's somebody who apparently is a sincere and devout, convicted Christian. She attends the Assemblies of God denomination. She and her husband, whom she met in high school, have five children, the youngest of whom is a Down syndrome child. And according to a couple of accounts I read, the couple was urged to abort the child. They refused to, which, of course, is a wonderful and godly thing to do. And I need to point out that it is my opinion that Down syndrome children are, if not literal angels, the closest thing to literal angels that we're likely to encounter.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. William, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was mentioning the fact that Sarah Palin and her husband have a child with Down syndrome, and for many, many years, before abortion was widely practiced in this country, it was something that was used selectively to target those developing children in the womb who were likely to have genetic conditions such as Down syndrome. There were genetic tests available, I believe, by the earlier mid-1970s, shortly after Roe v. Wade inflicted abortion on demand on our country, that made it possible for people to find out if the child in the womb carried the Down syndrome gene, and often they were the casualty of search-and-destroy type supposed medicine in the form of elective abortion. But Down syndrome children are, as I mentioned before the break, among the most loving and wonderful people you'd ever meet. And that's true of those who grow up into adulthood. Down syndrome, of course, can result in mild retardation and difficulty with some mundane chores that those of us who do not have that condition find perfectly simple to carry off. But they're, once again, wonderful, loving, exceptionally generous and kind and happy people. And the world is adorned by their presence. And I think that it is really quite a testament to the character of Sarah Palin and her husband that confronted with this unexpected burden, they treated it as a blessing, and now they have five beautiful children, one of whom, unfortunately, is serving in Iraq, the oldest, their son. And she's somebody who has a paucity of experience on the national scene and was considered something of an authentic maverick, unlike the pseudo-maverick John McCain, Sarah Palin, actually did confront the party machinery in Alaska. She managed to unseat a very corrupt and fairly popular but politically powerful incumbent governor. And she was somebody who in 1996, this is something I find interesting, was a supporter of Patrick Buchanan's insurgent campaign within the Republican Party. The theme of Patrick Buchanan's campaign in 1996 and in 1992 was to confront the New World Order, those instruments of collective power at the global and regional level on the world scene that tend to attenuate American sovereignty. Mr. Buchanan was talking in great and passionate tones about the idea of withdrawing our country from NAFTA, from the World Trade Mechanisms. At the time it was called the GATT, now it's called the World Trade Organization, that define the trade policy that we live with and thereby define our economic future. And of course he talked about getting out of the United Nations, or at least getting out of those entities of the United Nations that Mr. Buchanan thought represented untenable sacrifices of our national independence. I believe that our very presence in the United Nations is untenable, and that there's no excuse for us to be part of that organization. But back in 1996, when her political career was quite young...
Hold that thought, we'll be right, go right ahead there.
Back in 1996, when her political career was quite young, Sarah Palin was an enthusiastic supporter of Buchanan. And then this year, she had very kind things to say about Ron Paul. And her profile, to the extent that she has cut a figure on the national scene, is that of sort of a maverick, insurgent libertarian, small L libertarian Republican. Now, it's interesting that within a few minutes of the announcement that she was going to be at the bottom of the ticket, suddenly you heard from, among other people, Mr. Dobson, Dr. Dobson, James Dobson in Colorado Springs, had a focus on the family, who'd been a very outspoken critic of John McCain, and who a number of months ago said that he could not conceive of any circumstance in which he would vote for John McCain, said that he now has no compunctions about pulling the lever on behalf of John McCain. And that, of course, is a very important signal to the rest of the conservative, traditionalist, or Christian right in this country, that suddenly, by virtue of putting Sarah Palin on the ticket, John McCain has sort of detoxified himself, at least in the opinion of James Dobson, who has a great deal of political throw weight. I think that's the entire purpose here. I think Mrs. Palin does a couple of things that are important, the first of which is that she now serves as an implement that could be used to nail down the base of the Republican Party, the conservative, pro-life, largely evangelical Christian base that had been understandably disenchanted with John McCain for many reasons. His lifestyle, I think, would be at the top of the list, as somebody who had treated his first wife as abominably as he did, and somebody who is, in terms of his treatment of his marital vows, would be problematic to those of us who take Christian canons of marriage seriously. That would be something that would alienate a lot of the base. He's weak on social issues. He's weak on the defense of marriage. He's weak on the life issue. He's certainly somebody who is in bad odor with people who believe in border control and also immigration reform of the sort that is in a very passionate demand by the Republican base. Sarah Palin is perceived to be very good on all those issues, and she seems to compensate for McCain's weaknesses. And the fact that Mr. McCain is, I believe, 72 years old today and is the youngest first-time presidential candidate in the history of our country.
I think youngest or oldest?
Oldest, forgive me.
Okay.
That was a complete polarity shift.
That's
there.
All right. Go right ahead.
the oldest first-time presidential candidate in history does throw into sharp relief the fact that Sarah Palin is 44 years old, and somebody who very easily could find herself at the helm of the administration if they are elected in November. And I think that's something that, in the back of the minds of a lot of conservative Christians, would be seen as a good thing.
Well, yeah, but I think, of course, the important thing is that most Republicans, most Christians, are really sort of naive as far as how the system works, because the vice president, if the the president doesn't die, is simply a figurehead. Now, of course, it's a little unusual as far as Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney's the handler of George Bush. Dick Cheney, trial after commission, counsel on foreign relations, the real elitist. In fact, he was in charge of the committee to find a vice president. He could only find one potential vice presidential candidate in the whole country who should be running with George Bush, and that was himself. Mm-hmm. Now, that just gives you, show you an idea of how humble he is. But under any circumstances, this is very unusual. Usually the vice president has no function at all, and I think the only reason that Sarah was actually picked was because this would help John McCain get elected, and that, and of course the threat of war with the Soviets would certainly feel a lot more comfortable with a military man like John McCain in office than with an Obama in the presidency if we were going to have to go into a showdown situation with Russia. But I think it was a brilliant idea, but from a purely practical point of view, William, I don't think that she would have any influence at all on McCain administration.
Oh, heavens no. She'd have less influence than Dan Quayle had on the George H.W. Bush administration. And she's being compared to Quayle in a lot of ways, by way of derogatory comment on her experience and her perceived ability. But I think that there is this fond hope, and it's, as you say, naive, if not outright delusional hope on the part of many people, that she would actually inherit the office. And that would be problematic for at least some Christians. This is a really interesting contradiction here. Some Christians would have a problem with the idea of a female as the chief magistrate, to use the expression which is common in some Christian circles to describe the office of chief executive. There are some people who'd have a problem with that, and I think that there are probably relatively few such people. I think more of the people in the core constituency of the Republican Party would think that because she is seen, Mrs. Palin, as a fairly straight-line conservative, social conservative on all the matters, almost all the matters of great concern to the Christian right, that she's somebody who would have some kind of an influence, perhaps punch above her weight in an administration. Of course, as she pointed out, and this is something she's taken some grief for, but it's actually a very good question, she said she doesn't know exactly what it is that a vice president does all day.
I don't think they don't do much of anything. That's
no,
the thing.
They really don't. And unless, and of course, you're dealing with somebody who's a figure like Dick Cheney, who was sort of the Cardinal Richelieu of the Bush administration, the power behind the throne. He was somebody who was obviously, transparently running the administration. And he's somebody, as you pointed out, who had all of his tickets punched with respect to all the elitist organizations that are actually in charge of creating our foreign policy and our economic policy. I think Joe Biden, quite frankly, would serve a similar role in an Obama administration. Mr. Obama is well out of his depth in terms of what's going on with foreign policy, what's going on with economic policy. He's somebody who comes from a background that's academically, on its surface, apparently more impressive than that of Sarah Palin, but they're of a comparable age, and in terms of their experience, really, they're of very comparable stature. Mr. Obama is a first-term senator of no particular distinction. He was a state legislator of no distinction at all, and he's somebody who's very good at sonorously reciting a speech and making the appropriate contortions and theatrical gestures, but he's not somebody who's particularly bright when asked to extemporize on a given theme. And so he would be a suitable figurehead for what would be a Biden administration in the same sense that George W. Bush was a figurehead for what was in practice a Dick Cheney administration. And Biden, in terms of his policy performance on economic affairs and on international affairs, very much in the mold of a Dick Cheney. He's somebody who very enthusiastically supported the war in Iraq, for instance. He's a very much an internationalist in his outlook, very much in favor of continued entanglement in the affairs of other countries. He's very bellicose in his comments this week toward both Iran and Russia, and talking about, for instance, the need to be more assertive in dealing with Afghanistan and Pakistan, as was Obama. It's really interesting. Mr. Obama cut his teeth in the early primaries as a perceived alternative to the status quo, to the bipartisan consensus of foreign interventionism, and particularly with respect to the Iraq War. He was seen as somebody who wanted to bring an end to the Iraq War. I never for a minute bought that that was actually what he was interested in doing, but there were comments that he would make of studied lapidary ambiguity during the early primaries that led the anti-war element of the Democrat Party's base to believe that he was one of them, and there's a really palpable sense of betrayal now that he has emerged as a fully liveried liberal interventionist and left-wing hawk of the sort that we can trace all the way back to the despicable Woodrow Wilson. But he would be, once again, more or less the salesman for an administration in which Joe Biden, I believe, would actually have a fairly significant role, if not the definitive role. I don't think you're ever going to have, at least for the foreseeable future, a vice president who is the policy omnivore that Dick Cheney was. He was somebody who was, once again, obviously running things. I don't know if you're going to have somebody who's quite that forceful and quite that obvious presence. But Biden, I think, would be comparable in that respect. Palin would not, obviously. They would treat her as basically ornamental, the same way that Dan Quayle had almost nothing to do during the 4 years that he was the second in the executive branch under George H.W. Bush. By the way, this whole discussion underscores something I think which is important, which is the changing nature, or the radically altered nature, in any case, of the role of the vice presidency and the way that the executive branch was originally constituted. Originally, the way that the Constitution defined the assignment, it was the individual who got the second highest number of electoral votes who would be made vice president. And so you could have a serious downside, for instance, when you had a Thomas Jefferson and an Aaron Burr who hated each other, and an Aaron Burr actively conspiring against Jefferson's administration and against the interests of the United States. That's, of course, an extreme example of the downside of that. But the upside of that arrangement, of course, is that you have somebody who can exercise a check on the ambitions of a president who becomes a demagogue and a potential despot. And now, of course, we have a system where the presidential candidate chooses his running mate, usually before the convention, as was the case in both Democrat and Republican examples this year, and they end up with somebody whose job is simply to maintain a consistent heartbeat, which ironically enough is not something that Dick Cheney has excelled at since he was 34 or 35 and had his first heart attack. I don't mean to make light of that condition. I'm just saying that it's ironic given the fact that the one thing a vice president is supposed to be is healthy, hale, and vigorous to take over in the event that the president dies. You've got in Dick Cheney somebody who is actually acting as a president and who was sickly and in very bad health during both the terms of the Bush administration. Dr. Stan, you're exactly right. The vice president doesn't do a whole lot all day. And Sarah Palin, when she was asked a couple of weeks ago, I believe, what she would do as vice president, she said something to the effect that, I don't know what a vice president does with his time every day. I'm used to being productive. I'm used to having a busy schedule as a chief executive and doing things that I think are worthwhile, having a real hands-on role in administration and policy details. And, of course, that comment now is being orphaned from its context and is being used to make her look very superficial and unaware of the rudimentary functions of the executive branch. She very well knows, of course, about the presidential succession. She knows that a vice president would have to be briefed about security details and have to be kept in the loop regarding important policies because she'd have to go out and sell those policies. She no doubt knows that the vice president presides as the president of the Senate and casts a tie-breaking vote in certain contingencies. He knows all these things. It's just she doesn't know from point A to point B during a given workday what the vice president would do.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg as we analyze what's really going on.
Well, what's really going on, if you want to talk once again about the meta-issues here that define this campaign, you've got liberal interventionist war hawk A, liberal interventionist war hawk B vying for control of the executive branch, which means that no matter which party wins, you're going to end up with the same foreign policy with perhaps a slight difference in emphasis. As I've said before, Obama strikes me as somebody who is much more interested in the nation-building aspect of interventionist foreign policy, and John McCain seems to be much more comfortable in the realm of assertion of military power unilaterally when necessary or multilaterally when possible, but it doesn't really matter which specific vector they take. They'll both arrive at the same place because that is their nature from what we know of their history and their policy pronouncements. Certainly in the case of Obama, once again, with Mr. Biden as his wingman, he's going to be very interventionist. He's going to be very much the internationalist of a Wilsonian nature. Of a Clintonian nature. I mean, Bill Clinton, contrary to a lot of popular misconceptions, was somebody who was very promiscuous in the use of American military force abroad to advance internationalist designs, whether you're talking about the invasion of Haiti at the order of the UN Security Council back in 1993, 1994, whether you're talking about what happened in 1995 with the bombing of Serb positions in Bosnia and the use of an American mercenary army to train the Croatians to drive the ethnic Serbs from the Krajina region of what was the former Yugoslavia. That was done in order to bring about a peace settlement that basically turned that region over to the United Nations, and now Bosnia is a launching pad for radical Islamic terrorism. That's one of the chief foreign policy consequences of the Clinton administration, is the use of American power to create terrorist enclaves in the Balkans, in Bosnia and in Kosovo. And whether you're talking about Hillary Clinton or Joseph Biden or any of the other people who are really sort of in the mix here at the upper echelons of the Democratic Party, they're all very much enthusiastic supporters of that type of militarism. Even Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, she was the UN ambassador the first term, Secretary of State in the second term, was once quoted as rebuking Colin Powell, who at the time was the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for Mr. Powell's reluctance to get involved in some of these insane military ventures in Europe, and she said something to the effect of, what's the use of having this military if we don't use it? Of course, the purpose of a military is to use it to defend our country. It's not to advance these grandiose international designs that tend to be contrary to the interests of our national security, properly understood. And Biden and Obama are very much squarely in that tradition. And when you take a look at John McCain, he's somebody who is even more enthusiastic in the use of American military power for just about any reason that one can name. Both of these candidates have been very bellicose, once again, in their treatment of Russia over this war in Georgia that was precipitated by Washington working through a surrogate. The president of Georgia, Saakashvili, is somebody who was brought to power with Washington's help. There was a coup that preceded the election, and then the election was held after Mr. Saakashvili's minions were firmly in charge of the apparatus of electoral transition, and he ended up getting 96% of the vote. That's the type of percentage you only get in a dictatorship, quite frankly, or in a thoroughly fraudulent election.
Of course, remember, but the United States was behind Saakashvili. I mean,
exactly.
We remedied that whole thing. The so-called, Rose Revolution was simply an American coup there, but we can't let the American people know that. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was simply talking about, of course, the election of Saakashvili as the president of Georgia. I mean, he was picked by the United States. He was schooled by the United States. He was backed and financed by the United States. The Rose Revolution in Georgia was financed by the United States. And, of course, what William was just saying is that when the election was held, what was it,
95%?
96%.
Yeah.
Isn't that an amazing thing that if you honestly believe that, you know, Why you probably believe that George Bush won in Ohio, honestly, in 2004. So, ladies and gentlemen, we rigged that. We trained the military there in Georgia. We supplied the military, the United States and Israelis actually trained the military there in Georgia. And at least if you read the recent issue of New York Times, Putin has suggested that the United States told Georgia to attack south of Sesia, and of course they did. And Putin said, I think that this was all part of a program specifically to help one of the political candidates get elected. And of course he was talking about the idea that if we were at war, or there was a threat of war in south of Sesia and in Georgia, why that would help the candidacy of McCain. And even though I don't like Putin at all, why, of course, there was a certain ring of truth to what he was talking about. But I think everybody must understand that the Russians did not attack Georgia. It was the Georgians who attacked South Ossetia, and, of course, which was a breakaway province, and there were some Russians there, and some of the Russians were killed. The Russians sent their troops in, of course, to protect the Russians, to protect the people, the citizens of South Ossetia. And then, of course, they moved on into Georgia. There's certainly blame on both sides, but it is not all the Russians' fault. But there's plenty of blame there. We had no business being there trying to isolate Russia. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Putin has many contemptible things, but he's not a fool. And I've often thought that the chicanery in Georgia, and precipitating this conflict with Russia represented two entirely contemptible things, the first of which was a donation in kind, if you will, to John McCain's election effort, because he's somebody who has been branded now as the national security candidate in a period where we're seeing supposedly a relapse into a Cold War-type relationship between Washington and Moscow.
And that's exactly what Putin said.
Yeah. And the second thing that I think it is, this Georgian war slash reignition of the Cold War, if you can use the word ignite in the context of a Cold War, is a Keynesian stimulus to the military-industrial complex, because literally within hours of the Russian tanks rolling into South Ossetia and then into Georgia proper, you had a huge boost in the stock price of just about every one of the major components of the military-industrial complex, all these arms contractors, military contractors, the people who were joined at the hip with the Pentagon, did incredibly well. That's something that was reported very quickly in the Wall Street Journal, which keeps track of such things, of course. And so I don't think that Putin is telling a lie when he says these things. I think he's honestly persuaded that that's the case. I would go so far as to suggest, and this is purely speculation on my part, that not only are we seeing a situation in which Saakashvili was goaded and programmed, if you will, by Washington to attack South Ossetia. He'd been told months ago that in order to bring Georgia into NATO this October, they were going to have to settle the problem of ethnic separatism in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. So obviously there's a motive there, there's opportunity, there was the means. And I think that it's entirely possible that there might have been a back channel open to Moscow to let Moscow know what was going on in order to bring about a situation similar to what we saw, which is to say that the tanks were fueled and primed and ready to roll when the Georgian attack occurred on South Ossetia. And so the Russians could claim, in all honesty, that they were responding to aggression, but they were tipped off, I believe, by somebody in the Bush administration that this was going to happen. And one of the reasons I think this is so, and this is one of the few things that Mr. Saakashvili said that I agree with, he said it in an interview that was published in today's Wall Street Journal, this morning's Wall Street Journal, is that the tanks were ready to roll within hours of the action in South Ossetia, and it takes days to get the tanks ready for that kind of a maneuver. So obviously, they were waiting. They were anticipating what was going to take place. It could be good intelligence work on the part of Moscow. These people, of course, are in possession of a very good intelligence apparatus, and that, of course, is Mr. Putin's background, or it could be something more sinister. But in any case, the two things we need to remember are that Georgia did indeed draw first blood, crossing a boundary that is of ambiguous international status, but still is policed as part of a peace treaty, making South Ossetia a de facto independent province, which means that this was an act of aggression by Georgia. And the second thing we need to realize is that this is all being orchestrated to bring about certain political changes over here in the United States as much as anything else.
And I think it's so vitally important. People understand that nothing happens by accident. These things are all planned ahead of time. And if we let the Russians know, and I wouldn't be at all surprised, I believe there's a very close working relationship between our leaders and the Russian leaders. Of course, this is really all for the impact on the minds of the American people and the Russian people, too. Well, Dr. Stan, back here, I guess, is William Grigg. We're talking about the recent conflict in Georgia. Is this a prelude to World War III? So do the Russians now are going onto a war footing? They're moving their fleet into the Black Sea. And what are we doing? We're moving our fleet into the Black Sea, too.
Yeah.
Why would you do that? Why would you go over halfway around the world and do everything to antagonize a potential enemy, a nuclear-armed enemy that has 10 times more of the warheads than we do? Why would they have 10 times more? Well, because we've been unilaterally disarming as they've been increasing their armaments. But, of course, we can't tell the American people that because, of course, we've been funding them as they're supposedly disarming and haven't been disarming. And we've put ourselves into a terribly, terribly vulnerable position. And we have no effective, certainly, anti ballistic missile system here in the United States. We have, I think, 6 active missiles up there, and the Aleutians or somewhere in Alaska is supposedly going to protect us from the thousands of potential missiles that could rain in from Russia and China. Something's wrong with everything we're being told. Reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. William, pick up the story.
I do think it's interesting that one of the things Putin has complained about, and you have to give, once again, the devil his due here. I don't consider Mr. Putin to be in any sense a friend of civilization, but when he tells the truth for his own purposes, you have to examine what he says, if it's true, in order to understand the full picture. And he has complained, understandably so, about the fact that NATO has been pushing into what Russia calls the near abroad by absorbing the Warsaw Pact nations. All of them except for Albania now are members of NATO. There are a couple of former Warsaw Pact nations that no longer exist. Czechoslovakia, of course, through fission, was divided into the Czech Republic and Slovakia. They're both part of this European condominium. East Germany has reverted to Germany, and Germany is still part of NATO. We still have our troops in Germany, in the middle of a united Germany, which is a really anomalous thing. And then, of course, the Baltic nations, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, which were constituent members of the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, they're now part of NATO as well. You see Ukraine being brought into NATO, quite possibly, and Georgia, which geographically is rather at a strict reserve from Europe, from the North Atlantic, certainly. It's over there on the Black Sea. They're talking about bringing Georgia into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's nowhere near the North Atlantic. And so when you take a look at this, this 26-member armed alliance that is outfitted with a very sophisticated arsenal, and it includes many of the world's wealthiest countries. Of course, if you're a common Russian citizen, you see all those...
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with William Grieg. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William has simply been pointing out that the United States is systematically surrounding Russia. We've taken, of course, all of the Baltic states and Poland, and now, of course, swinging around towards Ukraine and Georgia. And, of course, what we're doing is surrounding Russia. You know, why are we surrounding Russia? And how are the Russian people going to feel about, you know, the potential of America wanting to go to war with their country? And, of course, we're doing everything we can to create this awareness of the war. Our fleet is confronting the Russian fleet in the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly our planes are confronting Russian planes, which are flying, certainly armed nuclear flights all over the world today, confronting the boundaries of American airspace. Is it possible if we're on the verge of World War III? Well, before we go into that, let's go ahead and ask William if we get his website out and tell our listeners how we can get his material.
I appreciate that. I have a daily blog, and by daily I mean I try to update it between 3 and 5 times a week, or more frequently as my schedule allowed. It's called Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase that means for freedom. The best and most convenient way to find it is to go to the website that is the homepage of the Welch Foundation. That website is called The Right Source, and the web address for The Right Source is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. If you go to The Right Source, at the top of the page there's a banner ad for my most recent book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And it's very easy for those who are interested in buying a copy of that book to click through that ad at the top of the page. You can order directly from the Welch Foundation. Radio Liberty very kindly makes it available to people who are interested as well, as does Amazon.com. It's about 300 pages, and it deals with the creation of, once again, this homeland security state, a garrison state, a militarized, centralized police state, the rudiments of which are up and functioning right now. We saw a really potent example of that in Denver this last week, and we're going to see another one in Minneapolis-St. Paul in the coming week. I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a few minutes, perhaps. But the purpose of that book is to help people understand how this has happened, the extent to which we are living under a police state. It's not something that many people encounter every day, but it's becoming more and more of an invasive reality in the lives of perfectly innocent American citizens. And also to talk about some of the things we can do to arrest the progress of this now no longer creeping but galloping tyranny and try to recover some semblance of ordered liberty, that is to say, liberty under God's law, which is the entire purpose of the American experience and exercise to begin with. So if you're at The Right Source, www.rightsourceonline.com, and you look at the home page, scroll down the screen, and look at the left-hand side of the page, readers, viewers, listeners will find a photograph of myself. next to a hyperlink that will take them to my blog, Pro Libertate, and they can click through there and read what I have to say. Pro Libertate is a little bit different from most blogs in that I try to produce a 1,200 to 2,000 word essay between 3 and 5 times a week. It's a work of commentary. It's an opinion piece. I don't color or shade or disguise my opinion. And furthermore, I think it's important for listeners to understand that if they're coming into my blog out of a background of sort of conventional Republican conservatism, there are going to be some things on that blog that are going to challenge you. This is not the same type of libertarian-influenced conservative writing that you would find on townhall.com, for instance. This is not the sort of thing that you would find on the corner on National Review Online, or the type of perspective you'd hear from Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, any of the people who are in the stable right now, the Republican-aligned commentators of a conservative bent. That's not what you're going to find on Pro Libertate, because my text, if you will, that I use to preach these sermons of discontent over what's going on, is the Constitution. I really don't care what the Republican Party's interest would be, or the interest of the Democratic Party either. My intention is to try to measure what's going on the basis of the Constitution, more importantly on the basis of God's law, meaning the Ten Commandments, and the two great commandments, the Sermon on the Mount, the Golden Rule. All these things are very fundamental to the outlook that's presented on Pro Libertate. I'm obsessive about the question of individual human freedom and the dignity of the individual as created in the image of our Lord and Savior. And so I have that perspective, and I use that to evaluate what's going on in the world. And people will be sometimes surprised, sometimes they may be shocked or even disgusted by the conclusions I draw. But all I ask of those of you who read what I have to say about any given issue, whether it's the war in Iraq, whether it's the merits of various policies pursued by the Bush administration or other Republicans, all I ask, if you take exception to what I write, and I do invite people to offer commentary, and the commentary is mediated, but I let anybody who has anything to say by way of disparagement or disagreement have his say on the comment thread. All I ask is that you show me where I'm wrong, because I reserve to myself the unconditional right to grow more intelligent on any subject, and I can't do that if I don't listen to other people. If somebody has a compelling point of view that contradicts what I have to say, and if you can make a sound case, I'll change my mind. I've been known to change my mind. I think that a mind that isn't changed regularly is of little use to anybody, as long as, of course, you keep your principles in mind, and you're governed by principles. So that's what Pro Libertate is all about. We have a lot of stimulating discussions in the comment threads after my articles. Once again, go to www.rightsourceonline.com. Or if you want to go directly to my blog, the easiest way to do it is to Google Pro Libertate, L-I-B-E-R-T-A-T-E, Pro Libertate, and Grig, and that'll be the first result that'll come up in a Google search.
Well, I certainly recommend it to people. It's an excellent site, lots of great information there. So go right ahead, William. You were going to tell us a little bit about your views on the upcoming Republican convention in St. Paul.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen, with respect to what's going on in the streets, which is always much more interesting than what goes on in the forum itself, is that you're probably going to have an even more intensive application of these garrison state techniques against street protesters than you had in Denver. And, of course, Denver was a very memorable experience for those who were there or followed it carefully in the uncontrolled, unofficial media. It's really quite a remarkable thing to see the spectacle, for instance, of a slight, small-boned 24-year-old woman to be hit, apparently, from what I can tell from the camera angle, to be hit in the face by a riot police officer who's using a baton, knocked off her feet as the riot policeman utters a horribly vulgar epithet at this prone woman. And then a couple of minutes later, while the woman is talking to reporters about what just happened to her, to have a police officer grab her by the wrist and arrest her for the supposed crime of talking to the press. That's just one example of the sort of thing that happened in Denver, where you had, of course, a collision between sort of a, how best to put this, sort of a rent-a-mob in the care and custody of professional agitators. I mean, the people who brought the protesters out in the street are obviously people who do this, if not for a living, as a serious political vocation. And on the one hand, you had these people in the streets. They ran into a very militarized, very hostile very efficient squad of riot police, 1,500 strong or more, who were brought in from several jurisdictions outside of Denver. And you had mass arrests after a group of the protesters found themselves walled off between two opposing forces of riot police. You had this other incident involving an ABC News reporter who was on the sidewalk, on a public sidewalk in Denver, across the street from a very Tony restaurant, taking video footage of a meeting between high-placed Democratic officials and very highly paid lobbyists, mega lobbyists who dispose of a lot of money in terms of campaign contributions and contributions to the party in general. And while he was taking this footage, a large and truculent police officer came and shoved him off the sidewalk, literally shoved him into traffic. And as this producer is protesting that he was on a public sidewalk disobeying no law, this arrogant and unpleasant police officer is saying, look, you're impeding traffic now. Is he shoving this individual out into traffic? And after this ABC police reporter ended up on the other side of the street, a few minutes later, a squad of five or six police officers showed up, threw him up against the wall. One of them put a chokehold on him. That's a really interesting thing. As you probably remember, Dr. Stan, about 15 or 18 years ago, the LAPD was forbidden to use a chokehold as a way of restraining a violent criminal suspect. And, of course, chokehold is a dangerous and potentially deadly thing, but on the escalation ladder, it's certainly preferable to shooting somebody. But they were no longer permitted to use that as a way of restraining somebody because there had been a couple of incidents where a violent criminal suspect died as a result of a chokehold. Well, in this instance, you had somebody who had done nothing by way of a crime against person's property or even public order, thrown up against the wall. One of the six cops who assailed him had his hand around the man's throat. There's a still photograph showing the reaction, the terrified reaction of this very small, very slightly built man as this chokehold is put on him. And as he's being arrested and taken away by this flying wedge of five or six police officers, one of them is heard on camera expressing to this individual the sentiment that the producer being hauled off to jail should consider himself fortunate that he wasn't beaten nearly to death by the police. Now, that's what happened in Denver this last week when you had street protests that were relatively small, relatively well-mannered. I think that the protests are going to be much larger in Minneapolis-St. Paul than they were in Denver because the Republican Party attracts a much more visceral reaction from the professional protesters. And as in Denver, they're probably going to be kept at a strict reserve, probably many blocks or the better part of a mile away from the venue where the convention is going to be held. This is in keeping with typical policy now. They create what are called so-called free speech zones. And in order to protest, you have to be protesting somewhere that is geographically isolated from the object or the subject of your protest. If it's, for instance, a presidential visit, you can be nowhere within visual range of the route of the presidential motorcade. You can't be seen by the president or by the vice president conducting a protest of the policies of their administration. You can't be seen by the public that turns out for the motorcade protesting the policies of the administration. When I was in Appleton, Wisconsin until 2005, back in 2004, we had several presidential visits and visits by John Kerry to Wisconsin. It was a key swing state in that tightly contested election. During, I believe, October of 2004, we had a visit by George W. Bush to Appleton, and actually to Green Bay, but the route went through Appleton, Wisconsin, which is about a half hour south of Green Bay. He had Air Force One land at the airport at Appleton, Wisconsin, and I noticed as I had to go to the airport and pick up a friend who was coming in the general aviation section of that airport. He was flying his own plane in from New York. I had to go through security in order to collect my friend, and then as I drove away, I looked out at the landscape. Just surrounding the airport, there were a couple of small little rises that are just barely above the general elevation of the landscape there, just in the outskirts of Appleton. There were sniper teams posted on the rises in the topography there. And from what I understand, there were sniper teams atop some of the larger buildings of the in downtown Appleton, Wisconsin, which is about 70,000 population. They had a motorcade of armored black SUVs in order to disguise which one was occupied by the president. The whole town was shut down. The whole town was put under martial law. And the protest zone, for those who wanted to protest the visit of George W. Bush, was so far away that nobody in the city of Appleton knew where it was. I couldn't find out where it was. I didn't know there were protesters, but they were basically thrown out of Allegheny County, Wisconsin for that day. Well, that's typical now of what happens, not only for presidential visits, but also for political conventions. According to the First Amendment of our Constitution, the entire United States of America is a free speech zone. But according to the people who operate the mechanisms of the Homeland Security State, we can only exercise free speech where they tell us it can be exercised and where it can do no good in terms of advancing the message by introducing it to those who may be unconvinced or unacquainted with it. It's exactly the same policy that took place that was implemented in Beijing by the communist Chinese during the Olympics. They had protest pens that were set up at certain places throughout the city where they were out of the way, difficult to find, and unobtrusive. In order to stage a protest in Beijing, you had to file an application with the Communist Party leadership, and they had to grant you an application. They turned down 75 of 77 applications, which is why they didn't have any protesters in the protest pen. The difference is that the protest pens here are filled up in the United States, and when people step outside them, they're immediately arrested, which is what happened in Denver. We'll probably see the same thing happen in Minneapolis-St. Paul. And the really interesting thing about this is that this is part of the whole choreography of what we're told is this deliberative process of representative government where we get to elect our leaders. We get to choose who it will be, who will head up the executive branch. We get to choose who it is who will represent us in the national legislature and Congress and Senate. And we're told that these conventions, these nominating conventions, represent what we're told is American democracy working on behalf of the interests of the people. And, of course, it's all a cynical charade. You know, from the coronation that takes place now, whereas we used to have conventions that were open and the results were not predetermined and prescripted, now, of course, they're just ratifying operations where they ratify the choice of the party bosses as they were selected well before the primaries take place. And they have aspects of a made-for-TV spectacle. And this is really exemplified by the literal apotheosis drama of Barack Obama as he gave his rather mundane and ordinary speech last night, where he was wreathed in glory and surrounded by a backdrop of Greek Doric columns. I mean, literally, apotheosis means ascent to godhood in derivative Greek. And the spectacle of the weeping and worshiping multitudes as Barack Obama all but proclaimed himself to be the resurrection and the life is probably the definitive distillate of what these conventions are supposed to do. They're supposed to be these scripted, made-for-TV spectacles intended to confer upon whoever it is who emerges from this controlled process as the president, to confer upon that individual a sense of institutionalized awe, elevating that person above the mundane population at large, and giving him a sense of divinity as the embodiment of this benevolent state that rules us. It's perfectly sickening.
But I think it's so important that people understand this is all scripted.
Yeah.
They determine it because they control the media. They control who is going to get to be the nominee. Now, of course, when they could not sell Mary Giuliani to the Republicans, why, of course, then they took the almost morbid campaign of John McCain, and, of course, they pushed him into a position of prominence. They started giving him fantastic amounts of money, which he hadn't had before. They really thought they could sell Giuliani, but they always have somebody waiting in the wings. Mm-hmm. The last thing they would want is somebody who was evangelical Christian, or certainly somebody like Ron Paul, who it captured the imagination of the American people. And had he had any media support, he certainly would have been able to be the Republican nominee. But that could not be allowed. You can't allow the people to nominate the person they want. The elite determines who the candidates are, the Republican, the Democrat, and ultimately who will be elected to the presidency. Well, William, go right ahead. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
We really need to encourage our friends and our families and anybody who's of like mind to understand the importance of what you were just saying, Dr. Stan, regarding the fact that this is an elaborate charade, that the real struggle for our freedom takes place in our local communities and in our hearts and our souls. And one of the most important things that's going to happen as a result of all these tumultuous developments we talk about is that the very architecture of power we've been describing is going to experience some really potent and disruptive shocks. And as unsettling as that prospect is, as daunting as it is to consider the possibility, for instance, that there will be a full-orbed collapse of the financial system as Fannie and Freddie fail, as the FDIC goes bankrupt, which is a legitimate possibility, as we see bank runs accumulate and bank failures metastasize, as daunting as that prospect is, there is a certain hopefulness, I think, in this, because this system has to be brought down. There's just no two ways about it. We're not talking about tearing up the Constitution. We're not talking about doing away with our Republican heritage. We're talking about restoring it. We're talking about chipping away the incrustations of collectivism and corporatism that have strangled and almost killed our republic and almost destroyed what we were given in terms of our Constitution. And it may take this type of tumult, this type of pain, but we have to help people understand that they need to find resources within themselves, more importantly, within their relationship with God and within their families and their local communities to deal with the times that are soon to be upon us. They can't be looking to Washington as a savior, irrespective of who gets elected this November. They've got to look to our real savior for help, and they've got to look to their friends and families and their local communities for the resources adequate to the challenge that's going to be imposed upon us very soon.
I certainly agree with you. I think we're moving into the most difficult times of my life, and I'm, as you know, 79 years old. But in many ways, it's exciting. We are going to have an opportunity to see this whole facade, I think, of course, eroded. I think we're going to find that people are going to have to determine what is really important.
Yeah.
I mean, is it money? Is it family? Is it values? Because, of course, when you lose your home and you lose your car and you lose your job, and, of course, there's a chaos on our streets, then people, I think, are going to begin turning back to God. That is, of course, the hope. The only hope for America is a third great revival. Let's just hope and pray it comes very soon. William, I appreciate so much your staying over so you could be with us tonight. Have a wonderful and safe trip, and
we'll
look forward to talking to you again next week.
Thanks so much, Stan.
Good night. God bless. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. We'll be back in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope you enjoy William of Grieg as much as I do. I enjoy hearing him. He's certainly one of the most articulate people we have on the conservative side. So it's a privilege to be able to present him to you, and we do hope you enjoy him. Now, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty has an amazing outreach. It's just started with one station. Now we have over 63 or 64 outlets every single week, and we're picking up a new one starting on Monday, a daily program in Spokane, a major center. We do need your help, and if you are in a position to help us with that, why, of course, we 5 days a week we're going to be on that afternoon station. We haven't been on it before. Drive time, 4 to 5. So, and then, of course, we're also going to be doing a weekend program to four or five stations there in Spokane. It's a wonderful opportunity. Tom Reed, the station owner, has been very gracious and helpful, but we still have to be able to finance this. So if you are in a position to help us, why, give our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. We have to, of course, be absolutely certain we're going to be able to finance the new stations as they come on board. And, of course, this is a unique opportunity, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration if you're in a position to helping us with a Spokane station or the other stations as they come on in the future. Our number again, 1-800-544-8927, if you are in a position to help us. And then, of course, I do hope that many of you out there will want to get a real understanding of what's going on. There is a secret government. We have a four-tape set on the secret government. We have a four-tape set on the secret societies. We even have a secret government special. you want to understand, of course, read the writings of Professor Carroll Quigley, who was the liberal historian, probably the leading historian of the last century, according to Samuel Huntington, who's today professor at Harvard. All right, Professor Quigley wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, where he told about the secret society that controls America. And, of course, the book was immediately suppressed. Somebody bought a Macmillan company, destroyed the place to the first half of the book. You can get the book from now from Radio Liberty. You can actually get the interview we have with Professor Quigley where he tells you this story. We have another wonderful book called Foundations, Their Power and Influence, and you can get Professor Quigley's book and this long-suppressed book going into how the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, have funded communism and socialism and internationalism and pornography and the Kinsey work here trying to destroy the moral fabric of our society. It's all covered in a book which we've kept in print for many years called Foundations, Their Power and Influence. So, if, of course, you'd like to get either one of the books or get the Tragedy and Hope special, which includes Foundations, Their Power and Influence, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, if you'd like to get the Secret Government Force tape set or the Secret Society's Force tape set or the Secret Society Government special, they're available from Radio Liberty. And then, of course, we hope you go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs live. You can listen to our satellite feed 9 hours a day, to our archive programs, and then to our MP3, and then to our blog programs. They're all there at Radio Liberty, free of charge. We want you to go down to the level where we talk about videos and watch the videos. They're free. We have another section on other videos, and there you can see Building 7 come down. Obviously a controlled demolition, and I just don't know how Osama bin Laden was able to do that. Do you? Well, and then, of course, you can read our newsletters. All of the information is there. You have our permission to copy it and to help us to try to get it out. Our telephone number again, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And ask the question to yourself, if I were to die tomorrow, where would I spend eternity? And if you have any question, you can always give us a call. Good night. God bless you.